I'm Afshin Rutansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. This week, so-called genocide Joe Biden plans to release his budget request for next year after months where he has failed to pass multi-billion dollar requests to support the proxy war in Ukraine and the war on Gaza. As for Palestine, after tens of thousands have been killed with NATO nation weapons, mostly women and children, now hundreds of thousands face famine. Aid convoys, lifelines carrying food, water and medicine are routinely denied entry to northern Gaza in what human rights organizations are calling a deliberate starvation of Gaza's civilian population by Israel. All this after both the USA and UK have repeatedly refused at the UN to back a ceasefire. Joining me now is someone who was an advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah on permanent status negotiations with Israel, Khaled El-Gindi, now senior fellow and director of the program on Palestine and Palestinian-Israeli affairs at the Middle East Institute, joins me now from Arlington in Virginia. Khaled, thank you so much for coming on. I should say that Gaza isn't even the top story in the countries which are supplying the weapons so that the genocide can happen. You describe the unprecedented nature then of what is happening. I mean, Israeli soldiers posting snuff videos of their killing of Palestinians in Gaza. People on social media can see it.
Yeah, it's actually pretty astonishing what is happening in and to Gaza. I mean, we've seen over the past 5 months the destruction of an entire society, its civilian infrastructure, most of its homes, most of its hospitals, all of its universities, hundreds of schools, mosques, churches. I mean, just the basic the basic foundations of life, and that's, you know, not even counting the tens of thousands who've been killed, the 20,000 orphans. I mean, the list goes on and on in terms of the scale of destruction. And of course, as you mentioned, we have these videos of Israeli soldiers gleefully mocking the people, you know, looting items from people's homes, mocking the people who escaped or were killed in those homes. And it's quite horrifying. And all we see from the West, really, particularly in the United States, is either silence in the face of atrocities, including the deliberate starvation of an entire population. And everyone knows this. And so either we get silence or we get kind of mealy-mouthed talking points, you know, from the State Department and White House spokespeople trying to deflect.
Airdrops. Or justify. Airdrops made the headlines of the papers. Yeah. Blinken does understand it, so says the State Department.
Oh, they absolutely understand it. And when the president comes out and says, you know, we won't stand for this, you know, clearly, you know, feigning moral outrage, he personally understands exactly what's happening. The State Department, the CIA, certainly, the Pentagon, the White House, they all understand that Israel is deliberately preventing humanitarian assistance from coming in. And they've hinted at kind of mild criticism, but they certainly haven't tackled it directly. And rather than confront that atrocity head on and call it out, they just circumvented by doing these kind of performative airdrops and hand-wringing, when the reality is the substance of the policy has not changed. There's been no interruption in the weapons flow to Israel. There's been no disruption of providing cover in the United Nations, vetoing resolution after resolution in order to shield Israel from any critique or having to stop this war. And it's, I don't know what there is left to say.
Well, one thing to be said was what made the newspapers of the country supplying the weapons for the killing, that the UN report led by Special Envoy Pramila Patten said it was all rape on October the 7th and you can compare the proportionality between the October 7th resistance attacks and what's happened to Gaza since.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that Hamas committed very serious war crimes and atrocities on October 7th.
Actually, are they war crimes? Because occupied people has the right to resist using armed... They're allowed to use weapons, aren't they?
Sure, yeah. I mean, there's no question that...
So why are you criticizing the October the 7th attacks?
Well, what I'm saying is the way in which hundreds of armed militants carried out those attacks, those were clearly, you know, attacking civilians, killing, wanton killing. Those are clearly war crimes. And I mean, there's no, you know, we have to, in the same way that we can't conflate Israel's right to self-defense with what they're doing in Gaza, which is committing more atrocities, starving the population. That's not self-defense.
But I'm just wondering why you call
but
October
I would argue,
the 7th,
let me finish the point though. But I would argue crimes. That what Hamas and other armed groups carried out on October 7th was also not a legitimate form of resistance. I don't think...
What is a legitimate form? Because Nelson Mandela would presumably have given it his backing, given Mandela famously saw the bombing of restaurants as a legitimate form of resistance under apartheid.
Yeah, but I don't subscribe to that view. And obviously Nelson Mandela was entitled to his view. But you know, my standard is based on international humanitarian law and international human rights law. And
international law allows armed struggle. International law
sure.
allows armed struggle against occupying
yeah.
authorities.
Yeah, right. So, you know, you can carry out armed attacks on the military, on any armed group that represents the state. Those could be considered legitimate targets.
Don't all Israeli adults have conscription? But all Israelis have to fight with the IDF.
I know, but you know, this is a dangerous path that we go down on when we start attributing kind of collective guilt. We have to understand, you know, it's the same mindset that allows Israel to bomb an entire building and say either, well, they all voted for Hamas or they all support Hamas or to attribute collective guilt to an entire people because they are, let's say, bureaucrats or civil servants in the Hamas-led government. I don't think that's a reasonable standard for who qualifies as a combatant or a legitimate target. I don't think even targeting a so-called militant in their home while they're sleeping and killing him and his family, I don't think that's legitimate when Israel does it. And I don't think it's legitimate when Hamas or any other group does something similar.
So sorry,
between combatants and civilians.
You advised the people in Ramallah, who clearly are don't have the best of reputations amongst the Palestinian people right now. What the Palestinian people are just supposed to trust these international kind of fora? I think there was the quartet, which I think Tony Blair was associated with for a long time. Russia's now pulled out of that one. You don't see that, I mean, obviously over the dead bodies of tens of thousands, mostly women and children, at least Gaza is on the map in world opinion now. The entire world, apart from NATO countries, support again the right of the Palestinian people.
Yeah, I mean, these are two separate questions, though. I mean, whether the attacks were morally or legally justified, the attacks of October 7th, and the question of whether they were represented a tactical victory for Hamas, those are two different questions. I mean, yes, Hamas scored a tactical victory, delivered a shock to the Israeli system in a way that this, you know, no Israeli government or public had felt before. So that's certainly from a strictly psychological and even political standpoint, sure, that was a tactical victory. But again, I think we can't confuse outcomes with sort of moral or legal justification. The bottom line is we know these kinds of attacks, they work. Terrorism works, right? It gets people's attention and it can even move the ball politically. And I would say not only terrorism by Palestinians, but also by Israelis and by Zionist groups. I mean, Israel's creation was very much in large part a result of terrorism, very effective terrorism against the civilian population in Palestine, against a British government and other targets. So terrorism historically has worked, but that's different than the kind of moral question of whether moral attacks on civilians are justified.
I wonder what it's like there in Washington. I should just say, in Britain, they don't teach much about the Irgun killing British soldiers at all historically. What's it like being there in Washington at the Middle East Institute there amongst and amidst the media landscape there? Because as far as I can tell, in the United States, the media are focused in on beheadings, rapes, and all sorts of atrocities committed by the Hamas terrorists. Is that the lens in
both
which
real and
Palestine
imagined
is now seen? I mean, do you give credence to Biden? They had to walk it back at first when Biden said he saw pictures of beheaded babies. What's your understanding?
Well, I mean, certainly the media coverage immediately after October 7th, for weeks and probably longer, was quite horrendous. It was sensationalistic. It was dehumanizing of Palestinians and Arabs and Muslims in general. It was, you know, irresponsible. You know, we saw people carrying these stories, these totally unsubstantiated stories like the beheaded babies, which later turned out to be false. And there is a, you know, I will say the media, the record of U.S. media in particular is mixed. There are those who ran with those stories kind of unrepentantly, and you know, we haven't seen really corrections. But we've seen other media, we've seen a kind of learning curve where certain media have adapted and responded much more responsibly since then. And there's much more coverage, and there's even a little bit more of self-criticism. And I think social
are you thinking,
media
are you thinking of the New York Times responding to the Gray Zone, I know, and Electronic Intifada and others did
right.
Work.
And I think alternative news sources and social media have helped to create a certain kind of accountability for legacy media like the New York Times. And they've had to, you know, they're being held to account for shoddy journalism and for unsubstantiated claims. And so it's really, it's a mixed picture, I think, in terms of the media. It's not all as horrible as it was in October and November. It is not at all, I would say, certainly not ideal, but it's hard to generalize. I mean, some outlets are better than others and have improved. Others have not.
Khaled El-Ghindi, I'll stop you there. More from the former advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah and now senior fellow at the Middle East Institute after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Khaled El-Ghindi, former advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah and now senior fellow and director of the program on Palestine and Palestinian-Israeli affairs at the Middle East Institute. Khaled, we were talking about the learning curve, albeit over the dead bodies of tens of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza. Why do you think on the ground, and I know there may be this learning curve, I understand that sources are saying CNN people are talking against their management at the moment in the coverage of Gaza, but in Palestine, Hamas has never clearly been more popular. Do you see Hamas as having been victorious in the sense of any kind of idea of a democratic election that might take place in the West Bank, let alone Gaza, once the NATO nation-armed genocide ends?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say. It's we don't actually know where Palestinians in Gaza stand at the moment. It's very hard to do polling in an environment where people are, you know, constantly just looking for shelter, trying to not be killed, trying to find some morsel to eat, or you know, get their children to a safe place or to some medical attention. This isn't, and of course, when there are frequent media blackouts, you know, where electricity is scarce and people have a hard time connecting their phones and other devices to the internet. So it's extraordinarily difficult to gauge public opinion in Gaza in this environment. What we do know is that there has been a surge in Hamas's popularity, at least in the West Bank, including in East Jerusalem, and among maybe Palestinians outside in the diaspora. You know, that is not unexpected because Hamas is seen as a group that has withstood this huge onslaught, the most powerful military in the region. They still have not been dismantled or destroyed, much to the frustration of the Israeli political and military leadership. And they're seen as a group that has inflicted pain and cost on their occupiers. And so for those reasons, we expect to see a surge in Hamas's popularity. But we don't know what that would translate into in terms of electoral support. And I think elections are very far off.
So what we have then is Hamas, perhaps more popular in the context of Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, an end to the reputation of these NATO powers that keep talking about a rules-based order, because clearly they're arming what's happening in Gaza. And we have Israel now, the most dangerous place in the world to be a Jew. So this is where the situation is at the moment.
It's not exactly how I would characterize it, but...
Tell me how you would, because clearly the Global South does not support Britain does at the Security Council or the United States.
There's no question that the so-called rules-based order has taken a huge hit. I don't know that it can recover. I don't know that the credibility of the countries and states who have claimed to uphold a rules-based order in places like Ukraine, I don't know that their credibility can ever really be restored, not just with the Global South. I mean, certainly with the Global South. I think it's not a coincidence that South Africa was the country that took up the case for genocide against Israel in the International Court of Justice. It wasn't an Arab state. It wasn't a Muslim majority country. It was South Africa. And so, yes, the Global South is not only disillusioned, but quite angry at this very obvious double standard and flagrant disregard for the most basic principles of, you know, people can debate about self-defense and when it's justified and what's over the limit. That's why we have the laws of war and international humanitarian law. But there's no instance in which the starvation, the deliberate starvation of an entire civilian population, could ever be justified for any military or political end. And so the mere silence, if not tacit or even open support for this policy by these countries, I think is eviscerated the idea of a rules-based order. And I don't know that it can recover, frankly. There's no question about that. And I think their credibility has been shot to a large extent in their own countries, in the United States, in the UK, in Germany, in other parts of the West, where we've seen mass protests, where we've seen major acts of civil disobedience. You have now an entire generation in the West who are completely disillusioned and who don't buy the official talking points coming from their leaders anymore. There's a major gap between the ruling elites in places like the US and the UK and the grassroots and the public. And we see that every day. I mean, the majority of the population in the US and in the UK overwhelmingly support a ceasefire and have for many months, but that is not at all where the political leaderships are in these countries.
I know the UAE sponsored one of the Security Council resolutions as part of its rotating place on the Security Council, but why do Arab nations take people like Antony Blinken seriously and meet up with him? I mean, he's a former military arms consultancy boss. We know Lloyd Austin, of course, will perhaps be profiting as a director of Raytheon from the amounts of arms transfer from NATO countries to support Israel. In fact, Blinken said, "I come before you not as a U.S. Secretary of State, but as a Jew," when he arrived at IDF headquarters in Tel Aviv amidst the genocide. Why do Arab leaders take Blinken seriously? I mean, Newland is gone in the past few days.
I think there's a number of reasons. One, it's because it's the United States. Even if they dislike very strongly U.S. policy, you cannot ignore the United States. Just the mere geopolitical reality of the United States as a superpower, and that has enormous influence in the region. People understand.
Well, I should just say, albeit the Palestinians and the ones you worked with, the Palestinians you worked with, they went to Moscow. And in fact, along with the King of Jordan, refused to meet Joe Biden when he hurriedly came over in the past few months to make some kind of, some people saw it as a bizarre visit to the region.
Yeah, that was early on when they refused to meet with him. The president hasn't been back. The Moscow meeting, yes, I think, you know, that was largely for show. I think at this point, Palestinian factions are each for their own reasons trying to show that they are committed to national unity. Obviously, the United States is not going to host a meeting that includes Hamas and other groups that the U.S. doesn't accept. And so Russia is one of the few places that can host a meeting like that. Russia has an interest in projecting its own power and influence in the region at the expense of the United States. And Palestinian groups have an interest in demonstrating to the United States that they're not the only game in town. But at the end of the day, Russia's influence is going to be limited. Russia doesn't have the depth of its involvement. It doesn't have, I think, the credibility with all Palestinian groups. And it doesn't have the bandwidth itself to do what's needed. I think that it's largely opportunistic, that Moscow is taking this up.
Well, Russia would obviously deny that. But on the other hand, it's not just Russia. Saudi Arabia, the UAE, what's up with the GCC no longer following orders from Washington in the past few months? Whereas historically, I'm sure you're a close observer of this, they would do what Washington told them to do.
Yeah, they're not following orders from Washington, but they're also not trying to alienate the United States. They are trying, part of...
Can one do that dance?
They have been doing that dance. I don't know how effective it is. But we're talking about regimes, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Egypt, that depend very heavily on the United States for their own security. And that, in the case of Saudi Arabia,
Security from who?
What? I mean, there are various regional threats, including Iran. But Iran
has close relations now. Again, the Iranian foreign minister visited Saudi in the middle of the night after the October 7th. Why is it that all Middle East think tanks in Washington believe that the United States has some sort of umbrella helping where I'm speaking to you from? Iran aren't going to invade the UAE or Saudi, are they?
No, obviously the detente between Saudi Arabia and Iran, that's something that is in Saudi Arabia's interest. There's no question about it. And I think it's not a coincidence that it was brokered by China. I think it was a clear signal to the United States. But at the end of the day, you look at the Saudi normalization arrangement with Israel that had been pursued before October 7th. It was, and that is still being talked about now. It was in large part to draw the United States back in to provide security guarantees to the Saudis to recreate a kind of U.S.-led security architecture in the region. The Saudis want that. And that is the only reason they're talking about normalizing with Israel.
Okay, but I mean, obviously,
they're
much
less interested.
Iran denies
in
has any moves
on
that.
In the United States.
Iran has denies any moves in on that, and there isn't certainly any talk right. about normalization here in this region. I'll tell you that just briefly on Trump's yeah. election in November, which I suppose is the likelihood, even if it's from jail. Will it get worse, the situation for the Palestinians, or given he wants a change in policy vis-a-vis Russia, to taunt with Russia, could this pave the way for something far better than we've seen under Genocide Joe, as he's called?
I mean, it's very hard to say whether it will be better or the worse or the same as far as this issue. I mean, obviously, a Trump presidency would have enormous implications for a whole range of domestic issues, not the least of which is, you know, basic civil liberties. And, you know, Trump has shown himself to be very unpredictable on foreign policy. It's very hard. He does not have a guiding vision or ideology. It is all very personal. It's idiosyncratic. And it's transactional and opportunistic, his approach to foreign policy. So, yes, when it comes to playing to his base, he will say things like, we're going to ban students who protest, you know, we're going to ban Palestinians from entering the country because, you know, you have this anti-immigrant sense and xenophobia that runs through the Republican Party. And so he's going to push those buttons because they're useful for him. But in terms of broader issues about geopolitics, it's much, much harder to predict what he would do. You know, we know President Biden does not believe in putting any public pressure at all, even on the most extreme government in Israel's history. And he's now being criticized by his own party in some circles for too tight of an embrace of Netanyahu and his extremist coalition. Whereas with a Trump administration, we don't know. Would Trump put up with a intransigent Netanyahu government in this to the same degree? I think his ego would dictate he would at least be willing to challenge Netanyahu
okay.
on some things.
Alan Elgedi, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US-EU armed bombing in Palestine, Lebanon, Yemen, Syria and Iraq. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media. If it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.